finds that Mr. David was at a minimum reckless in his failure to learn the specifics of the restrictions in place on June 22, 2012.
Three guilty verdicts for three Kuskokwim River fishermen. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a UAF scientist uncovers the world of ancient underwater reptiles.
So this was the consummate underwater predator. This was the animal that all others sort of quivered at the presence of.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
Three Kuskokwim River subsistence fishermen were found guilty today for fishing with salmon nets when they were restricted last summer. The trials taking place at the Bethel District Courthouse are just a handful of two dozen similar cases that will go forward in the coming months. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The politics of subsistence rights versus state restrictions weighs far heavier on the trials than the violations themselves, worth $250 each. The defense is arguing that the state did not properly notify the Yupik-speaking fishermen of the restrictions, which changed frequently during the low king salmon run in June. Defense attorney Jim Davis is with the law firm Northern Justice Project, which is representing all the fishermen pro bono.
And the king salmon season this year, Fish and Game issued not one emergency order, not two, but 22 emergency orders that Fish and Game expected individuals like Mr. David to know about on an almost daily basis about the new emergency order.
The state's prosecutor, Chris Carpinetti, is arguing that the cases are about an emergency order that was violated, saying they don't have to prove that the defendants knew about the emergency orders. And so far, the court agrees. The court has found that the state has followed the law and that the fishermen are responsible for learning the rules before they go out to fish. The first fisherman to face trial was 48-year-old Harry David of Tintatulac. He was found guilty for fishing with a net that was over 6 inches in mesh size on June 22nd. David testified that he didn't know about the fishing regulations. He said he didn't have a VHF radio or a computer to check. He said he did have a radio, but didn't listen to it all the time. And he said he never saw an order posted in the village. Here, he is being questioned by his attorney, Jim Davis.
And you didn't know you were breaking the law?
No. No, I thought it was 6 inches or less, because we used it before. It was my only, it was the only net my sister had. She told me it was in the boat, and she told me go fishing, that they lifted the closure.
Magistrate Bruce Ward said that it was David's responsibility to know what was legal before he went out fishing, and that ignorance is no excuse.
The court finds that Mr. David was at a minimum reckless in his failure to learn the specifics of the restrictions in place on June 22, 2012, the date that he was cited.
The court found that the way the Alaska Department of Fish and Game distributed the emergency order was adequate. That included announcements in English and Yupik on the radio, a Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group member from the village disseminating the information, and a Fish and Game worker hand-carrying the emergency order to the village tribal council June 20th. The defense told the court that the fishermen wanted to explain why they were out fishing for subsistence. That happened in the second trial for 58-year-old Adolf Lupi, also of Tintatulac. He said his parents fished and fed him salmon all his life.
I grew up eating crayfish. Now they're gone. I still go out there and taking over. Every year we move to the fish camp.
One specific sticking point that the court found in Lupi's case was that although he testified that he didn't know about gear restrictions, the judge wondered why he told the trooper citing him that his 8-inch net was just 6 inches.
He surely, the court can find, would know the difference between 6-inch and 8-inch gear just to his naked eye based on his experience.
The third case went just as fast. Emil Williams of Bethel was found guilty for similar reasons. He was fishing with larger net gear on June 25th. All three fishermen were sentenced to a $500 fine with half of it suspended, and they were put on probation for 1 year. Two other fishermen trials that were scheduled for Tuesday were postponed until January. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
145 million years ago, oceans north of mainland Europe teemed with ancient marine reptiles. A region east of Greenland and north of Norway also was once home to a whole slew of giant seafaring scaly creatures.
It is literally one of the richest places on Earth for marine reptiles like plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs.
That's Pat Druckenmiller. He's the Earth Science Curator at the University of Alaska Museum of the North. His latest work on Svalbard was recently published in a large volume of the Journal of Norwegian Geology. KUAC's Emily Schwing sat down with him to find out more about his work.
Pat Druckenmiller is a member of the Spitsbergen International Research Group. It includes geologists, sedimentologists, and other scientists who've spent the past 7 years digging up ancient marine reptiles on Svalbard. It's a group of Norwegian islands above the Arctic Circle.
So what we were really doing there wasn't just looking at marine reptiles, but getting a big picture view of the whole ecosystem. What were the ocean conditions like? What was the water depth? What was the water temperature? What kind of invertebrates were living in the sea at the same time that may have been at the base of the food chain for example, for marine reptiles? So we really took a big picture approach.
Druckenmiller just wrapped up his final field season there. To be fair, Svalbard was located further south by about 10 degrees latitude during the late Jurassic, a geologic period that began 160 million years ago. Back then, the region was slightly warmer. It's home to what Druckenmiller calls a bonanza of giant marine reptiles.
We're not really sure why it's so rich. That's sort of still the million-dollar question. What we focused on was, let's take advantage of the fact it's so rich and document the new types of things we find here. And lo and behold, almost all of the material we uncovered turned out to be new species.
There are two major groups of marine reptiles from this period, plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs. Since 2006, the group has excavated 37 enormous skeletons of each from a band of rocks that spans 4 million years.
37 skeletons over seven field seasons. That put that in perspective. I would estimate that there have been probably not much more than 20 skeletons excavated in the rest of the world over that same period of time anywhere else. It also means that this process of discovery is going to be going on literally for years to come as that material gets cleaned up and we start to examine it in new light.
At least six of the skeletons represent new species. Two of them come from a pliosaur. It's a type of plesiosaur. It was a 40-foot-long top marine predator.
And this animal has a skull that would have been 2.5 meters, or in other words, 6 to 7 feet long. Just the skull with teeth larger in diameter than the teeth of a T-Rex. So this was the consummate underwater predator. This was the animal that all others sort of quivered at the presence of. We also named three new types of long-necked plesiosaur, the ones that sort of look like the mythical Loch Ness monsters. And one of them, in fact, was pretty remarkable because it had 60 vertebrae in its neck.
In other words, that plesiosaur's neck was 8 feet long. It's the longest neck ever discovered from an animal living during the Jurassic anywhere in the world. All of the material uncovered on Svalbard is currently housed at the University of Oslo in Norway. The team will clean the bones and make molds and casts of them. While the fieldwork has come to an end for the time being, Druckenmiller says that doesn't mean the project is complete.
I would estimate we easily have another 10 years of what we call fossil preparation, cleaning up the bones, just to see what we have. Plus, as we're uncovering that material, it often takes a year or two of work just to actually properly document, describe, and compare each skeleton to other things. So it's a slow process. It's a very slow process. And I suspect that I'll be working on this material for another 20 years of my career. So that keep me busy for quite a while.
Druckenmiller says it's likely the group will head back to Svalbard to continue digging in a few years. He says it's quite possible at least one of the marine reptiles discovered could make its way to Fairbanks one day. For KUAC News, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Homer residents accuse Buccaneer Energy of overstaying its welcome in the Homer Harbor.
And are you here to destroy our way of life and disrupt this community? Because that's your name.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge would create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Gathering information about the scale of the problem of sex trafficking in Alaska will be the focus of a state hearing on the issue next week. The lengthily titled State of Alaska Task Force on the Crimes of Human Trafficking, Promoting Prostitution, and Sex Trafficking will hold hearings in Anchorage and Bethel. Corey Badgley is an assistant attorney general with the state. She says domestic violence and sexual assault of children are usually in the backgrounds of victims of sex trafficking. She says it's important for Alaskans to weigh in on this crime.
We just would really encourage those that have something to say on this topic to either give us their written comments, come in and testify before the task force, or call in to one of our hearings, because we do really want to hear perspectives around the state.
Badgley says many Alaskans don't realize sex trafficking is an issue within Alaska. Today on the statewide call-in program Talk of Alaska, the topic was sex trafficking and internet prostitution. Sergeant Kathy Lacey, who heads up the Vice Unit for the Anchorage Police Department, said Alaska was one of the first states to prosecute a sex trafficking case in 2003. Sergeant Lacey says APD received a federal grant to address foreign-born victims of trafficking in 2005.
But what we were seeing in Anchorage, on the streets of Anchorage, were the girl next door was working and being trafficked. So domestic sex trafficking was far larger than anybody had an idea of. But that's what we found. We found runaway kids being trafficked right on the streets of Anchorage. So it kind of changed the way we looked at it, and the internet changed the way that we did business. It's just incredible the amount of sexual exploitation that goes on the internet.
Lacey says online trafficking has made it easier for pimps or traffickers to hide their businesses. She says although prostitution may involve adult women, sex traffickers target young girls, bringing them into a life of misery at 14 or 15 years old. She says the problem is enormous.
It is literally everywhere. And I've said to people, it's almost as basic as if you have men and women, you're going to have prostitution. If you have prostitution, you're going to have sex trafficking. It's almost that basic.
The task force hearing on human and sex trafficking will be held at the Legislative Information Office in Anchorage on Monday, November 5th. Another is scheduled for Bethel in December. Links with information are at our website, alaskapublic.org. A public meeting between representatives of Buccaneer Energy and concerned Homer citizens turned contentious last week, with many people wondering why the company's Endeavor jackup rig is still parked at the Homer Harbor nearly 2 months after its arrival. Company officials say the rig will soon be moving to drill in the Cosmopolitan unit near Anchor Point. But as KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, the state of Alaska says that's not likely to happen.
It was a packed house at the Best Western Bedarka Inn in Homer Wednesday night as locals gathered to ask pointed questions concerning Buccaneer Energy's activities in the area. The conversation quickly turned heated, with some audience members leveling accusations instead of questions, including this exchange between an unidentified man and Buccaneer spokesperson Mary Ann Pease.
The definition of Buccaneer is pirate sea robber. They are piratical adventurers who raided the Spanish colonies of the American coast. And are you here to destroy our way of life and disrupt this community? Because that's your name.
Thank you so very much for your little history lesson there.
One point of contention Wednesday night was permits, specifically whether or not Buccaneer has the necessary permit from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation to drill in the Cosmopolitan unit. Buccaneer Vice President Mark Lant said the company had filed with DEC for an amendment to its blowout contingency plan, or C-plan, permit that would allow it to drill past an October 31st deadline. The company, he said, was expecting to be able to move the Endeavor into the Cosmopolitan unit to begin drilling, quote, no later than mid-November. But according to Graham Wood, section manager in DEC's Industry Preparedness Program, that's not likely to happen.
The Buccaneer has asked us to consider that what we would call a minor or routine amendment, and we have denied that request and informed them that that amendment will be reviewed in the full public process.
That letter of denial was sent to Buccaneer October 19th, says Wood. And as of right now, Buccaneer has no approval from DEC to drill at Cosmo. He says the public process that Buccaneer will now have to go through will likely take at least 85 to 90 days. Meanwhile, the city of Homer is trying to figure out what will happen with the Endeavor, which arrived at the Homer Harbor August 24th and was originally supposed to be in Ketchumak Bay for only 8 days. A series of delays, mostly involving needed repairs and upgrades to the rig, has caused it to stay, and a severe windstorm in mid-September forced its operators to put the legs down, something that has caused controversy over whether the Endeavor's presence violates the Ketchumak Bay Critical Habitat Area plan. At the last Homer City Council meeting October 22nd, Homer City Manager Walt Reedy said Buccaneer still has not received authorization from the U.S. Coast Guard to move the Endeavor rig, and now the city of Homer is preparing for the possibility that it may end up at the harbor all winter long.
And that, of course, from Buccaneer's point of view, is the preferred alternative because it's easy, much, much easier and much more efficient to work on that thing if it's here. But the legs down issue has to be resolved. And we have pretty much told Buccaneer that if you want to stay here for the winter, you got to have the legs down because otherwise it's not safe.
Reedy says the immense size and triangular shape of the rig make it difficult, maybe impossible, to store at the deep water dock without the legs down. Plus, the presence of the rig at the dock is interfering with normal harbor business.
We're actually turning commerce away. You know, other vessels that would like to dock.
Buccaneer Energy had planned another meeting Wednesday night at McNeil Canyon Elementary School. That one focused on its plans for land-based drilling at West Eagle, an area 21 miles east of Homer. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. If you're curious about the rich marine and terrestrial life of the North Pacific and are looking for an educational adventure, then come to the Sitka Whale Fest on November 1st through the 4th. Hear from prominent scientists, enjoy a 5 and 10K run and a variety of fun community events and whale watching cruises. Early registration and discount information at sitkawhalefest.org. Whale Fest is a program of the Sitka Sound Science Center. This message sponsored by the Sitka Whale Fest.
A Republican representative from the State House, Anna Fairclough, is hoping to unseat long-term Democratic Senator Betty Davis from Anchorage. Redistricting changed the playing field. The new Senate district now includes Eagle River, where Fairclough has been a popular candidate in the past. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Because of redistricting, Senator Betty Davis is running in a district that includes a lot of new territory. The new district includes less of East Anchorage, which she considers a stronghold, and adds some of Eagle River, which tends to lean more conservative. But Davis, who has served in the legislature for more than a decade, says she doesn't believe that the new portion of her district in Eagle River has very different concerns than the rest of the district.
And they probably won't be much different from what they are on the east side of town as far as that, but there are certain projects and things that they'll be asking for money to come into those projects, or if there's issues that they have. I have represented part of Eagle River before, but it was when I was on the House side way back in the 90s.
A former nurse, Davis says she hopes to be reelected so she can continue passing legislation to address Alaska's most pressing social issues.
I'm running for my seat again because I feel that I have many things that I would like to continue my work on, particularly in the areas of health care and education.
Davis's most high-profile work in the Senate in recent years has been on Denali KidCare, a state-run children's health insurance program for low-income families. Governor Sean Parnell vetoed bills she helped draft to increase funding for the program because he said they included support for abortions. Fairclough has also focused on social issues, most notably her work in the House of Representatives on the Alaska Children's Trust Bill, which passed in 2010. It's a fund set up by the legislature to provide grants to organizations that work to prevent child abuse and neglect. She's also worked for nonprofits, with Standing Against Rape, where she was the executive director, and with Hospice of Anchorage, where she currently works as development director. In addition, she's been in the House of Representatives for 6 years. Before that, Fairclough spent more than 7 years representing Eagle River on the Anchorage Assembly. She says if she's elected, her focus will be on fiscal planning.
Currently, I serve on the House Finance Committee and have taken up several issues important to all of Alaska, most specifically fiscal planning. Alaska has a bright future in front of us, but we need to take care of our fiscal house. We need to put that house in order. We have great opportunities on the North Slope to access riches for Alaska, but we need to do those responsibly.
Both candidates say education is a priority, but they disagree on how to improve it. Davis supports more funding for public education and existing district charter schools. She does not think public funding should go to private schools. Fairclough, on the other hand, supports funding that follows students to the school of their parents' choice. In Fairclough's mind, money for education is directly linked to oil. She says she would have supported Governor Parnell's bill to decrease oil taxes that died in the Senate last session. Republicans said it would increase oil production. Democrats called it a giveaway to the oil companies. Davis says the current tax plan, known as ACEs, is working fairly well. On the issue of a gas line, both candidates say there's a lot of work to be done.
We have to get onto a real conversation about the knobs that need to be turned, the criteria that needs to be changed so that it can be a viable project.
I'm very supportive of an in-state gas line, and I hope that we move beyond the talk, and I agree that we do need to come together and make sure that we move in that direction, because there are places that are hurting and need that reduction in gas.
But neither one has specifics about how to jumpstart a gas line project. As far as the bipartisan coalition is concerned, Fairclough says if elected, she would not support it. She says the group is often a dead end for bills crafted by her party, and it avoids controversial topics.
It has been ineffective. It hasn't taken on issues that are critically important to Alaska.
Davis has worked in the bipartisan coalition and says she'll continue to do so because she believes it's critical to collaborate across party lines. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Incumbent Mat-Su Valley Republican Charlie Huggins is being challenged for the Senate seat representing Wasilla, Big Lake, and Point McKenzie by Democrat Susan Parsons Herman. Huggins is a Vietnam veteran who says he'll stick to the party agenda. Herman is a professional therapeutic masseuse with long roots in early childhood education. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The Senate District E race is not likely to tip the balance in the legislature, but its outcome could shed some light on how Matanuska Valley area voters see their future. Republican Senator Charlie Huggins, who is not a member of the Senate Bipartisan Working Group, has 2 terms in the legislature behind him, serving last year as Senate Minority Leader. Susan Parsons Herman says she worked for the Democratic Party for years until raising her children took her away from politics. Now she's back, and Herman says she's running because of her passions, education, and health. She thinks the state could do a better job at funding both.
I certainly support Obamacare. I'm a recent cancer survivor myself, and it's critical that we all get affordable health care.
But Huggins can point to how the state has improved health care in his district.
We just built a new health clinic in Willow. The state, in cooperation with some private agencies, so that people could go in their local community to an affordable health care service. In addition, we participated and supported a new Native health treatment facility that just opened in Wasilla. I'm proud of that. So we are making that difference. Are there other things that should be done? Yes. Do I support Obamacare? No.
The issues in the Valley are the economy, education, and health, much like the issues facing the country as a whole. And the two candidates reflect pretty much the same Republican-Democratic standoff on how solutions could be found, like the state budget, for instance. Herman says she'll take a stand against proposed tax breaks for the oil companies.
Oil has certainly funded our state for years and years, but we need to get away from that. We need to diversify our economic base. I want to make sure that whatever tax breaks are given to the big oil companies, that they promise to give us throughput for that. I'm against the big oil tax giveaway. We need that money to fund our state and our programs.
Huggins says getting jobs moving depends on encouraging more oil development.
We have to address investment and decline in oil production. 90% of our revenue comes from oil. We have to monetize our gas, build a gas pipeline in one form or another for export, but most importantly for the use of the people of Alaska. And we're going to have to get the operating budget under control.
And Huggins would like to see large resource development projects move ahead. Herman wants jobs closer to home to keep Valley residents from having to commute for work. There are some similarities between the two. Both candidates agree on the Kinnickarm Bridge. As a former Kibata board member, Huggins says the state should pay into some of its costs. Herman says Kibata would benefit the Valley by providing an industrial development area at Port McKenzie. Both have three children. Two of Huggins' children are in the military, facing deployment to Afghanistan. Two of Herman's children left the state after college, she says, because there were no job opportunities at home. Herman says the state should spend more on education to reduce the high school dropout rate in the Valley.
We need to hire more teachers and more teacher aides. We need to put more money into the schools. I think if we can promote teachers, teachers aides, even volunteers in the classroom, we can get those numbers down and maybe even eliminate that high dropout rate.
Huggins says more vocational training would better prepare young people for the job market.
It has to be relevant and prepares them potentially for a vocation going forward to make a living. Most of our young people in the Valley, quite frankly, are doers with their hands.
Campaign funding could affect the outcome of the race. Huggins started the campaign with more than $38,000 and still has about that much in the campaign chest. Herman started her campaign with $2,000, mostly garnered in small amounts from retirees, and is just about that much in the red at this time. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.